Welcome to The Sound of Economics. I'm Anya Quinn.
And I'm Brim Watkins.
We're bringing you this podcast series from Bruegel, the Brussels-based think tank specialised in economics and economic policy. In this episode, we have Jeffrey Frieden, Professor of Government at Harvard University, speaking about the creation of a single currency in the United States. The US is often seen as a model monetary union for the euro area, but the monetary history of the US was long and difficult. There were many crises and setbacks along the way. Especially the early years saw constant struggles. This overlooked part of American financial history has now even found its way into the limelight on Broadway. The smash hit musical Hamilton was launched in 2015. It tells a story of the founding father Alexander Hamilton and his plans for a US central bank.
Professor Jeffrey Frieden specialises in the politics of international monetary and financial economics. In a recent lecture and essay for Bruegel, he compares American monetary and financial history with the development of the European Monetary Union. He also took some time to speak with us about the ideas in his piece. Frieden's first point was a warning to Europeans who think of the US Monetary Union as a template for Europe.
Europeans don't often understand that the American Monetary and Financial Union was extremely difficult to achieve. In Europe, the order of the day, among other things, is to try to figure out how to move forward to have a common economic, monetary, fiscal, financial policy. Whether that will go forward or not still remains to be seen. In Europe, it's very much an open question. Many Europeans invoke the American context and the American experience as an example of how a common currency, a common fiscal and financial union could be formed. What I think most Europeans don't recognize is that it was extraordinarily difficult for Americans to create that common economic and monetary union. In fact, for many of the first decades of the American Republic, we did not have a single currency. We did not have a common central bank. We did not have a common financial system. In fact, for some of that period, we had state-level financial and monetary orders in what might be regarded as an almost chaotic mess of competing currencies, competing state debts.
So, building the USA's monetary union was a slow and difficult process. This sounds frustrating for Europeans, but in fact, there could be some comfort in this. Maybe the current crises in Europe are just teething problems. Well, if Europe is just at the beginning of a journey to monetary union, how did things get started in the USA?
The story begins really in 1789, when Alexander Hamilton is appointed Secretary of the Treasury, the first Secretary of the Treasury in the nascent American government. The country had no currency. The country was frozen out of international capital markets. And in fact, the 13 constituent states of the Republic were pretty much all in default or close to being in default on their debts. So Hamilton had a revolutionary, so to speak, plan to try to restore the creditworthiness of the United States. And that was to do what was called assumption. It was called assumption because it involved the federal government assuming the debts of the various states. These debts had been accumulated over the course of the revolution. The revolution was fought largely by, to some extent, getting money from foreigners. The French, the Dutch, the Spaniards contributed to the revolution because, of course, England was their enemy, so the enemy of their enemy was their friend. But it was also financed, to some extent, by issuing worthless paper currency, that is, by inflation, and by issuing debts that by 1789 were not being paid. So there was a whole class of creditors, foreign creditors, domestic creditors, who were not being paid by the various states. Hamilton believed that it was crucially important for the new federal government to establish its creditworthiness, and so he very controversially proposed to take over these heavily indebted states and or take over the debts of the states and start paying them off with haircuts. That is, he imposed costs on the creditors, but he started paying off debts that had been in many instances in default for 10 years.
In the euro area, the idea that states might need to cover each other's debts is highly controversial. Well, the same was true in the USA's monetary union. Frieden explained how overcoming this controversy was vital for the USA to establish its monetary credibility. But stay tuned for a twist later in the story, where the USA's very own no bailout rule will cause havoc for big spending states.
It was controversial because, of course, it meant that the taxpayers were going to be asked to service debts that had not been serviced for a long time, that the more solvent states were going to be asked to pick up the debts of the insolvent states, which had a distributional effect, and it implied the reorganization of the country's finances on a modern basis. Part of this plan on Hamilton's behalf was to create a new central bank, which was called the Bank of the United States. It later became called the First Bank of the United States for reasons that we'll see eventually, that would act as the fiscal and financial agent of the U.S. government and would also supervise American monetary and financial policy. This was very popular with the commercial and financial groups in New York, Philadelphia, Baltimore, and Boston. It was very unpopular with the farm states and the farming groups that didn't want to have central control over finance and central control over monetary policy. And that raises a broader question about the politics of monetary and financial policy in this period.
There's more parallels with Europe here. Different regions and different interest groups all feeling that they need different monetary policies. In the case of the USA, there was tension between cities and more remote areas. While the cities were comfortable with central control, the remoter areas tended to be skeptical about centralization. Likewise, the more established economies in the Northeast had different wishes from the rapidly expanding frontier lands further west.
So Hamilton eventually wins out, the first bank is set up, the state debts are assumed, and immediately the government acquires creditworthiness. And the federal government now is capable of borrowing abroad, and the first bank, the Bank of the United States, which is based in Philadelphia, starts establishing a financial system. So you get a modern financial system gradually built up over the course of the years. But again, these conflicts erupt because the Bank of the United States is a bank which is trying to restrain money supply growth, to restrain economic activity, because it doesn't want to encourage or doesn't want the country to fall into high rates of inflation. It doesn't want to get into a circumstance where loans are being extended that can't be serviced. It wants to make sure that the financial activities are reliable, that fiscal policy is relatively conservative. And so the bank acts in a variety of ways to restrain the activities of banks on the frontier and of financial activity on the frontier. This gives rise to a lot of opposition among farmers on the frontier and in the rapidly growing areas. So you have, over the first 20 years of the Republic, this conflict again between the more stable, fiscally and financially conservative regions, New York, Philadelphia, Boston, Baltimore on the one hand, and the more rapidly growing farm regions in the South and the West on the other.
In Europe, progress towards monetary union is often described as irreversible. The fear of a backward step drove European policymakers to do all they could to keep Greece in the euro. But does it have to be this way? For example, was the emergence of American monetary union a one-way street? Well, to put it simply, no. In 1811, the first central bank of the USA was closed altogether. Why did this happen, and what were the consequences?
Congress refuses to renew the charter of the Bank of the United States because it wants to free itself from the restraints that Hamilton's bank is imposing on economic growth and activity. The timing was poor. They did this in 1811, and the next year, war broke out with England, and since we no longer had a fiscal agent that could borrow reliably on international and domestic capital markets, there was no way to finance the War of 1812, and we ended up losing it to the British and getting our capital burned. So after the war was over in 1815, Congress reconvened and said, well, maybe having a central bank is not such a bad idea, and they established a second central bank, which is now called the Second Bank of the United States, also based in Philadelphia. The underlying conflict of interest remained, however. And eventually, what happens is that Andrew Jackson comes to power as president, and he came from Tennessee, from a frontier state. He is extremely hostile to the second bank of the United States, and eventually convinces the Congress not to recharter it, so the bank is closed down. So once again, the more conservative or fiscally and financially responsible actors are defeated by the rapidly growing frontier. And starting in the 1830s, as the bank is closed down, you get this huge borrowing boom on the frontier. From 1836 onward, for the next 6 or 7 years, the state governments and banks and farmers and canals and railroads on the frontier borrow massively in order to be able to finance the expansion of economic activity that's going on. Of course, the borrowing boom leads to a bubble, and eventually, in the early 1840s, the bubble bursts, and 8 states and 1 territory are in default, can't service their debts. Well, remember going back to assumption that Alexander Hamilton had convinced the federal government to assume or take over the bad debts of the states. And one of the reasons people had been willing to lend to the states in the 1830s was they expected that the federal government would bail out the states if they got in trouble. But what happens in 1841, 42, 43 is it's only 8 states that are in trouble. And the other 15 states say, we're not in trouble. We're the reliable ones. We're the responsible ones. It was Georgia and Michigan and Illinois that got into trouble. Why should New York and Massachusetts pay to bail out those states? And there was no bailout, right? So in the first instance, the federal government did bail out the states, and that created a certain amount of moral hazard. In the second instance, there was no bailout. The states defaulted. So again, thinking about this in the broader context, you had this division between the more conservative creditor segment of the population that says reliable, responsible economic policies, don't overborrow, don't overlend, don't expand the money supply. And on the other hand, you have the frontier saying, lend us all the money you can, expend the money supply, run inflationary policies. And this conflict eventually gives rise to the crisis of the 1840s, where eight states fall into default, are not bailed out, and it takes 6 or 7 years for the country to recover from the crisis of the 1840s.
Now, so far we've largely been talking about central banks and institutions. But for most people, the real symbol of a monetary union is a single currency. So where was the US dollar in all of this chaos? In Europe, the central bank and the single currency, the euro, are seen as two inseparable parts of the same project. But, as Friedan explains, the history of the dollar was a bit more complex.
We, in fact, did not have a single currency. We did not have a single currency in the US until 1863. From 1789 onward, there were national bank notes circulating when there was a first and second bank, but those banks didn't last for that long. By the 1830s, the second bank had been closed up, and at that point, what started circulating were private bank notes issued by state-chartered banks. And in fact, what that meant was that the bank notes of various state banks traded at a discount to the dollar. So you had bank notes called dollars issued by Georgia banks that were only worth 60 or 70 cents on the dollar. Banknotes issued by New York banks were reliable. They traded for a dollar on the dollar. Banknotes issued by Illinois banks traded for 80 cents on the dollar. So you had, in a fundamental sense, state currencies floating around and trading at discounts over the dollar for many, many years. It wasn't until the Civil War, 1863, the National Banking Act, that these state-chartered banknotes were eliminated and a national currency was created, the greenback, the U.S. dollar. Now, I'm not saying that you need a civil war in Europe to have a single currency, but I think this indicates how complex the process of melding different economic units into a single monetary union can be.
Looking back on the monetary history of the USA, what does Jeffrey Friedan think that Europeans can learn from the story as they continue to build their own common currency? His first point is that we should forget the notion of an apolitical monetary policy.
Despite what many may think, monetary policy is always political. There are always going to be conflicts of interest. There are always going to be those who want monetary policy to be looser so that they can borrow more easily, and those who want monetary policy to be tighter so that they can make more money on their savings. In the United States, that was largely a regional issue, where the Northeastern financial and commercial centers were the tight money, more conservative monetary block, and the frontier was the more loose money, more expansionary monetary block. But in virtually any union, in virtually any country, there are going to be conflicts of interest over monetary policy. And the notion that monetary policy can be apolitical and it could ignore these political conflicts of interest, I think, is a pipe dream.
In his second piece of advice, Friedan discusses the purpose and legitimacy of a political union. Looking at monetary policy, there is a difficult balance between the central authorities and the member states. Both need to be credible and responsible.
The challenge for the European Union is to prove that the central institutions of the European Union are capable of solving problems that the individual member states are not capable of solving on their own. Otherwise, why have a union? Why have a union of sovereign states if everything that the union could do could be done by the states themselves? The only reason to have a union is that the whole is greater than the sum of its parts. So Hamilton went about early on proving that the whole was greater than the sum of its parts. That is, that the central state authority could do something that the individual units could not do. But that then creates a problem. It creates a problem of moral hazard. Because if the central authority is going to take responsibility for the debts of the states, then the states have no incentive to restrain themselves when they start borrowing. The same thing is true in the European Union. If the European Union is seen as taking responsibility for the financial activities and perhaps the financial misdeeds of its member states, then there is no incentive for the member states to exercise restraint as they move forward. Right? So the way that worked its way out in the American context was when people expected a bailout in the 1930s, in the 1830s rather, and didn't get it in the 1840s, it demonstrated that although the central authority could take responsibility for the actions of the states, it was not going to bail them out when they engaged in irresponsible behavior. And that is, in some sense, the fundamental problem that the European Union faces today. On the one hand, the European Union needs to establish the willingness and ability of central authority to deal with problems that individual member states can't deal with on their own. On the other hand, it has to make clear that the member states are responsible for their own behavior. So you need central authority while reducing to the minimum moral hazard.
And there's one final thing that I'm sure all the Europeans listening want to know. How long is this going to take? The euro area feels exhausted by these years of crisis, and many are hoping for stability. Well, we might have a while to wait if the USA's experience is a roadmap for Europe.
Europe is trying to create some form of monetary, financial, and fiscal union. In the US, it took something on the order of 80 years to get a monetary union, something on the order of 150 years to get a financial union with a common central bank, and something on the order of 150 years to get a fiscal union. I'm certainly not of the opinion that it will take that long for Europe to achieve those goals, but I think the history of the very difficult trajectory of the U.S. as it moved towards monetary, financial, and fiscal union indicates how troubled, how politically difficult and fraught the European experience is likely to be.
That brings us to the end of this episode. Jeffrey Frieden's essay, Lessons for the Euro from Early US Monetary and Financial History, is available in full on our website at www.bruegel.org. There you can also watch a video of Jeffrey Frieden delivering a lecture on the topic. On the Bruegel website, you'll find extensive analysis of European economic and monetary union. Join us next time for The Sound of Economics.